Hello, publishing fans. Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. My name is Sean Farrell.
And I'm Sam Wins.
And we have a very special episode for you today, the Mysterious Galaxy Birthday Bash Celebration Book Mitzvah.
Yay! 14 years in the independent bookselling business.
That is no small feat. How do you feel about it, Sam?
I'm excited. It's been rocky at times. It's hard for independent businesses, but we have great support from regular customers and authors and even certain publishers. So because of people like you, because of our friends at the store, we've been able to do it. So it's been wonderful. It's been a ride.
We're here to celebrate Mysterious Galaxy and bring you six authors who are there for the day. And those authors are...
Jan Burt.
Jeff Marriott.
Susan Hubbard.
Charlene Harris.
Marshall Karp.
And A. Lee Martinez. And there were other authors who dropped by, too. Werner Vinge dropped by just to say hello. Who else came there?
Some other local authors, like Jeff Edwards, who wrote a very good military thriller. And I know there was a couple others that I am forgetting off the top of my head, and please forgive me.
Yeah, that's the great thing about being an author. You can be famous, and yet no one knows who you are.
Incognito.
Yeah, so it's the best kind of fame, because you can still go out to restaurants whenever you want. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
So let's get into this Mysterious Galaxy bash, shall we? And then we will see you next time. Anything you want to add?
Keep reading and keep supporting those independents.
That's right. Oh, in fact, if you want to support Mysterious Galaxy and Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, go to adventuresinscifipublishing.com and click on either the book covers that you see under Mysterious Galaxy's name or the link for Mysterious Galaxy. You can do two good things at once.
And you can look at my book reviews on Mysterious Galaxy's website.
That's right. Lots of good stuff for you there. All right. We will see you in a couple weeks. And welcome back to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. We are coming to you live from Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore. Ooh, they're excited. Celebrating Mysterious Galaxy's 14th birthday. And we have several author events we're going to record for you today. And first, we are going to speak with Jan Burk. Ladies and gentlemen, Jan Burk.
Well, actually, I'm not Jan Burk today, and I'm not alone. I also have Randy Hicks with me, and we're here as Elaine Veets. Yay for Elaine! We'll get Elaine to listen to this podcast in Florida. About a month ago, almost to the day, one of those times when you open an email and you read it and you get a complete shock, and that was that Elaine had suffered a major stroke. And in fact, for those first 48 hours or so, many of us worried whether or not she'd be able to survive it or what kind of condition she would be in after her stroke. So the great news was that although it was a major stroke, she survived it. And not only survived it, but seems to be in really good shape and really progressing well and recovering well. She was able to speak almost immediately. She's got a little trouble with balance, I guess, now. But working on that, and is expected to be home any day. She was actually supposed to be home Thursday, but they decided to keep her a couple of days in the hospital because of, I guess, like a rash, skin rash or something. They wanted to clear up some medication problem. But she's doing really well. But as you can imagine, or I hope you can imagine, if you're an author and you've got a new book coming out, that's a lot of stress on anybody. And if you realize that there is not any possibility that you are going to be able to go on tour and do all the promotional work that you know the book needs, and you start to think about bookstores canceling orders because for tours. They usually order enough, of course, to have on hand at the event and all of that. All her anxieties, once she was sort of conscious around, were about what was going to happen to her book tour. And indeed, some of the chain stores were already, you know, sending things in saying, okay, you know, we're backing off. So her friends started saying, you know, what could we do? And we decided to hold a tour by proxy. And we said, we're just going to stand in for Elaine wherever she was supposed to be. And we put this call out. And honestly, I thought if we can get just 20 volunteers to stand in for Elaine at these events, we'll be able to cover her tour. In the first 48 hours, we got 200. So I've spent the last month... I've spent the last month as a assistant maniac to her publicist, answering emails from those people. But it's just been so heartwarming. It's been... I think a tremendous reflection of what our community as readers and writers are in the mystery community. I've always thought of this as a generous community, but if anybody ever needs some sort of tangible proof of it, I think this tour by proxy is it. So, Randy, why don't you talk a little bit about Elaine and as far as you what you know of her, because you don't know her personally, right?
That's right.
So, and I don't know if Randy Hicks, we sort of semi-introduced you, but he's so generous he brought avocados, but I'll let him.
I'm Randy Hicks. And yeah, I don't even know Elaine, but it's a tribute to kind of what Jan was talking about, that, and I've only got one mystery book out, so I'm kind of new to all this. And the first thing I learned was just what a neat group mystery writers and mystery readers were. I mean, I've been a mystery reader for a long time, but I'd never met a real mystery writer till I wrote my own and started meeting people. And Elaine has one of those names in the community of just everyone that's a writer knows her and says great things about her. And she's one of those people that really works hard for the group. And so it was, you know, neat for me to do one little tiny thing to come and help out. I mean, I'm going to buy a couple copies, put one of my Mother's Day baskets for my wife and my mom. So that's something great that you might want to do. And the avocados, the tie-in there is I have an avocado grove. And my character has an avocado grove, so when I do signings, I bring these. So please take one. I think there's enough for everybody. So I was trying to think to what to talk about, because when we do our own signings, when we talk about our books and what inspired us to write, I thought, well, you're to talk about Elaine, so what can I talk about that kind of ties in for Elaine? So what I was thinking of is, you know, her series is about this lady on the run and having to take these dead-end jobs and whatnot. So I was thinking about my very first book signing on kind of that part of my life. So I was going to tell you about that. My first book signing was in Orange County at a book carnival, and owned by a very nice couple, Ed and Pat. And needless to say, I was terrified about the whole thing. I mean, I became a writer so I could sit alone in my room and write. I had no idea writers actually had to go out and do this till I was told, you have to. So my immediate dream was crushed. So I was told to go out to this thing, and the only thing worse than going out to a book signing and worrying no one's going to show up is to do it in the town where your parents live and know that no one's going to show up in front of your parents as they stand there. Kind of like reliving, you know, the senior prom all over again, like, you know. So I'm getting ready to go to this thing, and I'm already nervous as it was. And I think I'm looking about as good as a guy can look at my age. And I'm walking out the door, and my wife stops me and says, well, you're not wearing that shirt, are you? And it was my favorite shirt, and you know, it hid my lack of biceps. And I said, well, what's wrong with it? And she said, well, that's the shirt you wore for your book jacket photo. If you wear that, people are going to think you only own one shirt. So I go back up, and I change my shirt, and I'm coming back in, and my son, who...
We just have to stop for a second. Okay. How many of you people do wardrobe checks on the book jacket? All the time. Okay, yep. Well, I guess okay. She was right. I'm going to be more conscious of this now.
So I'm walking in, my son, who is a teenager, so he never has anything nice to say. And he said, what's going on with those pants, Dad? And I'm thinking, you know, my pants were not visible in my author photo. I said, what's wrong with the pants? He says, well, like, totally high water. You can see your socks. And I look down, and, you know, and he's right. So I go up, and I change my pants, and I come down. And my daughter, who is only, at the time, she was 11. So she's still sweet. Everything, you know, Dad does is great. And she heard her mom's comments, and she heard her brother's comments. And she sees me, and she says, Dad, I think you look great. And you can hardly see yourself where you cut yourself cutting your ear hair. See, you can hardly see the blood where you cut yourself. So with that vote of confidence, I went to my first book signing. So that's my story on my first book signing.
Well, and I also have to say that I'm happy with the 14th anniversary because I was one of your first authors here at the store. So it's really great to kind of bring all these things together. I love this store. They have been so good to writers and readers over those 14 years. I know all of you are here and, you know, to celebrate that too. So a little bit about Elaine's books, because I think the concept she has for the series is terrific. It's the Dead End Job series. And Helen Hawthorne, the protagonist, is basically hiding out from her ex. And so she takes a series of low-paying jobs. And Elaine researches all of these jobs by actually working in them. So she's been a telemarketer, a bookstore clerk, sorry about the dead end part of that. It was a chain store, entirely different experience, I will admit. Yeah, and actually she goes into that in the book. She's worked as a dog groomer at a doggy boutique for very... These are dogs that have their own birthday parties and get little outfits made for them. It all takes place in sort of the crazy high dollar end of South Florida. So she's got and she's done all kinds of things. Worked in a bridal shop for the world's most spoiled bridezillas. So she's done all that. This book will never, you'll never have the same feeling about staying in a hotel again. She worked as a maid in a hotel, basically. And she does this, she doesn't just do this for a day or two. She does this for months at a time. So she was in there changing, you know, 38 beds a day. And doing all that work. And really, the books are great because they're both humorous. She has a great sense of humor. So they're funny, and they're if you have friends, you know, if mom doesn't have the CSI sensibilities you do, if you know somebody who likes a humorous mystery, this is a great kind of mystery for them because they definitely have humor in them. But she also manages to talk about the people who are invisible in our lives, who provide all this support to us. You know, that person who comes in and cleans the room while you're out at the mystery convention or whatever. She really, I think, shines a light on the lives of those people and is really great about talking about what people have to deal with that we may not always think about. I think anybody who can make me feel sympathetic for a telemarketer has done a great job. So that I'll tell about Elaine. Because she's obviously not here to sign them, she is, though, and as a part of her therapy, she's signing book plates. So if you get a book, I'll give you the information about how to send an SASE off to get a book plate from her. And naturally, because she's just now getting home and she's not supposed to just exhaust herself there, it may be a while before you actually get the book plate back. But she is definitely committed to sending those back to you. So maybe what we should do now is just see if people have questions. Oh, well, Elaine and I met in hell. No, we met, it was actually at the time. We met on the MWA National Board. At the time, MWA had a lot of problems. They had just, fairly recently had a big upset in the board. Things were kind of shaking out still from all of that. And we were in one of the first boards to sort of come in after all these changes. So there was a lot of rebuilding going on. And in the time since then, the membership of MWA has more than doubled. So we feel that there's been, you know, a reinvestment in the organization by people. And I think that is in part because they had somebody like Elaine on there. I'll tell you a story about her. When she was on the board, she has this background in journalism. She worked for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And in fact, I owe, you'll find Elaine's name in my acknowledgments for Bloodlines, because she was one of those young women who came out of college in the 70s and was told, honey, we don't hire women for hard news. You can go work in the fashion department and write fashion stories. So she wrote an expose about the fashion industry, which was not exactly what they were looking for. I didn't help those advertising dollars too much. But they finally started to kind of figure out that her talents were being wasted, you know, and let her start covering hard news. But she had this great ability, very, very strong sense of ethics about, you know, this is the proper behavior for, you know, people who are going to be on a board and in an organization, and helped us. When I started a training program for the board, she helped with all that. But we needed a treasurer at one point, and because there had been all these problems, you know, people don't want to touch being the treasurer, you know, because that's going to be kind of sorting out the money mess. And she said, you don't understand. I can't even balance my checkbook. You know, I would make such a bad treasurer. And I said, balance a checkbook. I said, this is why God made bookkeepers. You know, you aren't the person that balances a checkbook. You can smell a rat. You know, you have that journalist ability to nose out where things have been going wrong and to figure out what we need to set in place to make sure they don't ever go wrong again. And she did that wonderfully. And the organization has these fantastic procedures and things in place now that prevent it from going down that old road. So, you know, that she again gives like thousands of hours of her time in volunteering for Sisters in Crime. She's on the national board there as well, and MWA, and not just me. A lot of the emails we got in those 200 emails went something like this. The first time I went to such and so convention, I didn't know anybody, and Elaine took time to welcome me and make sure I felt comfortable. So, you know, that's who she is. And that's, you know, I think again and again, it was somebody, you know, like when I was first starting out, she helped me here, or she did this or that. So I think that's a lot of why we got that response also, is just who she is and what people know, what she gives.
And now she can greet them and make their bed.
The day started just like any other day. Always does. Until I watched one of my closest friends die. Right in my arms. Nothing I could do. But his death was a beginning, not an end. And now I've been thrust into a timeless conflict of pyromaniac insects and instant mummification. A war within our very genetic makeup. And when the powers of the ancient world collide with modern technology, no one is safe. Not me, and certainly not you. I'm Dr. Phil D'Amato, NYPD Forensics, and the only way to save myself is to solve the mystery of the Silk Code. The Locus Award-winning novel by Paul Levinson comes to life in this free podcast novel. Journey into the ancient world, witness the wonder of ages past, and join Phil D'Amato in a struggle against forces both ruthless and unseen. Visit www.thesilkcode.blogspot.com to learn more about the author and the novel. And subscribe today at patiobooks.com. Join the battle, witness the wonder, or forever be victim to the awe and power of the Silk Code. Phil D'Amato is ready. Are you?
everybody give a warm applause to Jeff Marriott. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for being here at Mysterious Galaxy's 14th birthday party instead of being at the Louisiana Festival down by the bay. We don't have gumbo, but we have cake later on, so it's just as good. I am here to talk about mostly my new book, Missing White Girl, which doesn't officially exist yet, so we're all transported a couple of weeks into the future. The official on-sale date is April 29th. May 29th, excuse me. Thank you. We are in May. It's May 29th. This will be on sale, but Patrick wrangled special permission somehow to get it on sale here for today only. There were tears involved. Okay, for today only, and then we have to hide it away until later in the month. Doesn't really exist, but it's here. A couple of other new things have come out recently that I'll mention briefly. Las Vegas, Sleight of Hand, based on the NBC TV series. That's Nikki Cox on the cover. Radio audience, take a look. And DC Universe, Trail of Time, came out in March. This is a Superman book that sends Superman back into the past and through various points in the DC Comics history, including Camelot and the Old West, where he meets up with some of the DC Comics Western characters, Jonah Hex, El Diablo, Scalp Hunter, and Batlash. Superman or DC Comics fans, there's that. I will also mention this, which Mysterious Galaxy isn't carrying, but you could order, and we have a couple of copies here today. It's called Lost Trails. It's a Western anthology that just came out, and it's the first time I've done a straight Western story rather than a supernatural Western story. The point of the anthology is stories about real Western people, only these are the stories that were never told before. And it has some of the best Western writers working today in it, and Louis L'Amour, who is not working today but still has books coming out every now and then. So it's got Louis L'Amour, it's got Elmer Kelton, it's got William Johnstone, Lauren Estelman, and one by me called The Ones He Never Mentioned, which is about John Wesley Hardin, who was a Texas killer back in the day. So that's Lost Trails. And then Missing White Girl, as she said, is kind of a supernatural border thriller set on the Arizona-Mexico border, set specifically in the Sulphur Springs Valley of Arizona, which is where we live. I did a lot of like hands-on research, not quite Elaine Veit style. I wasn't working in a hotel, but I covered all the ground that is mentioned in here. I went to the border with the Border Patrol and a local reporter who does a lot of border stories, border coverage, who's a buddy of mine. And actually what happened was I knew he liked to go to the border, and so I called him up and I said, hey, let's go to the border. He said, okay, I'll call the Border Patrol and let him know. And I thought you could just go to the border, but turns out it's not a good idea. So I said, yeah, I'll call the Border Patrol. So a couple of weeks go by, and then I said, well, why? He says, well, because you have to tell them you're going, or else they'll stop you and they'll question you and stuff while you're there. So a couple of weeks go by, and he calls up and he says, all right, we're meeting this Border Patrol guy at 1 o'clock on Tuesday. And I said, so we're going with the Border Patrol? And he said, well, yeah, because he knows, you know, what's going on. If you have any questions, he can answer them. And he has a gun, so if there's any trouble, you know, you'll be safe. What have I gotten myself into? All I wanted to do was go look at the border. But the two kind of overwhelming forces that made me want to write this particular book were the border issues that are going on. San Diego is a border town, kind of, but way up in this part of San Diego, we don't feel it as much as the people who live close to the border. In Arizona, we live about 12 miles from the border. In that 12 miles, there's not 1.5 million people. There's a few thousand people, so it's a very different kind of experience. There are a lot of border issues. We have the Minutemen, the kind of border vigilantes down there. You see people sitting in lawn chairs with guns and binoculars, hoping they can spot somebody, hoping they can be involved in an arrest. So there was that aspect of it. And then there's the aspect of the media circus surrounding Missing White Girls, the whole Natalie Holloway thing that Rita Cosby was obsessed about on MSNBC for so long. And I'm sure CNN had, well, Nancy Grace probably was the CNN idiot involved in it. So I got to make fun of them a little bit. So what happens in this is that there is a missing white girl in the town of Sierra Vista, and that has become a media circus. And so all of the resources of the Cochise County Sheriff's Office, water just appeared magically for the radio audience on the table. So the resources of the Cochise County Sheriff's Office are tied up on this high-profile missing white girl case. while that's going on, a family is murdered and the teenage daughter of that family disappears. And that family is of mixed race, black father and a Mexican mother. The media is not all that concerned about her because they've already got their story and there's the white girl's still missing. So there's a sheriff's lieutenant named Buck Shelton from this very small Elfrida office of the Cochise County Sheriff's Office. He and his people have the sole responsibility of finding out what happened to Lulu Lavender. In that investigation, they run into some of these border vigilantes. They also run into supernatural difficulties that stretch all the way back to the first Europeans and African to cross into what became the American Southwest in the Cabeza de Vaca expedition, which began in 1528, I think. So kind of stretches way back and ties the Cabeza de Vaca expedition into contemporary times. Just briefly, I'll talk a little bit about the Cabeza de Vaca expedition, which was, I guess, the third aspect that I always wanted to write about. Cabeza de Vaca and a few other Spaniards were shipwrecked in one of those gulfs, I forget, Gulf of Florida, but they were separated from most of their party. Some of them survived, but four of them actually found one another and crossed from what I guess would have been the eastern side of Texas and possibly into Arizona, although different scholars dispute what the actual route was, but they crossed Texas, New Mexico. They were looking for Spaniards who would have been in Mexico, and they only had the overland option. But as they went, they met different indigenous tribes and were sometimes captured and enslaved and sometimes not, but discovered in themselves, or again, scholars' interpretations vary, or tricked the Indians into believing them to be healers, and eventually started making friends along the way, and friends turned into followers because of the healing power that they had. So when they eventually made it into Arizona or Mexico, wherever they caught up with the existing Spaniards, they had more than 1,000 people from different tribes that they had passed through, going tribe to tribe with them, and they were friends, and they were, you know, they had a positive, favorable impression of these people. And then they got to Mexico, where the Spaniards were enslaving the Indians, rounding them up. Cabeza de Vaca and his people had one experience of the indigenous peoples, and then when they found the people that they were looking for, they discovered that those people had an entirely different experience to them. They were subhuman beings who just were meant to be enslaved. So it was a very awkward situation for him and his few people. Those three forces come together in this book. It's scary, and I should say that when I was reading the proofs, I got to the last 150 pages or so, and I was like flipping pages and going, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And then remembered that I wrote it, and I knew what was going to happen next. So I thought that was a good sign that you know, it will hold the reader's attention. So are there any questions?
Any questions?
I pretty much work every day. I probably get to the desk at 8:30 or 9 and knock off around 5 and break for lunch in there somewhere. When I'm working on something with a deadline, I usually try to do about 3,000 words a day. At the beginning part of this year, I did a novel based on the TV show Supernatural that comes out in November, and one based on the TV show CSI Miami. I'm not sure when it's coming out. So those were both deadline things. So essentially for the first 5 months of the year, I was nose to the grindstone doing the 3,000 words a day. Right now I'm kind of between things. I'm working on a proposal for one. I have a Spider-Man novel that I'm supposed to do later this year, but I'm not starting it yet. And so I'm doing a lot of ranch work on the side and trying to clear a fire break. And thank you guys for being here.
Gilroy 2.0 is here. Gilroy 2.0 is everywhere. Gilroy 2.0 commands you to listen to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Do you comply?
Hi, guys. Hey, I'm Sam. I'm sure most of you are familiar with me. If you're not, I'm Sam here at Mysterious Galaxy. I'm the Young Adult Program Coordinator and, you know, just general peon gopher girl as well. I wanted to introduce Susan today specifically because I got an advanced copy of her book, The Society of S, and I could not put it down. I loved it. I thought it was beautifully written. In fact, I was reading another book that I was really enjoying, and I put that book down to finish her book. I was completely engrossed from page one. And also because I'm picking it as the number two book for my second pick for the young adult book club I have started here at the store. It's technically not a young adult book, but I think it's very appropriate for ages high school and up, since it's a coming-of-age novel. It deals, not only are there vampires in it, but it deals with what it's like to grow up and learning who you are as an individual and learning things about your family that maybe you had not noticed before.
They're vampires.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited to introduce today Susan Hubbard. Please give her a big round of applause.
All right. I'm so happy to be here. I'm in the middle of a 10-city tour. So when I wake up in the morning, I really don't know where I am. But when I pulled the curtains and saw the flowers and the sunshine, I had to be California. And it wasn't L.A., I can tell you, because I've just come from there. I want to talk about, how many of you are writers, first off? Show of hands. Okay, five. And how many of you are readers? We hope. Yeah. All right. We hope some of you are both. Good. One of the experiences I've had since the book came out on May 1st is doing some interviews with print media and a couple of TV things, and then traveling around to small and large bookstores. And I feel as if we're all kind of partners or allies in a battle to save literacy. Does that make sense? Because I think that both newspapers and books are not as fashionable as they once were, and a lot of people now are just living their lives without reading, and that makes me very sad. In my other life, I'm a professor of English, so it makes me doubly sad when I have creative writing students who don't read. And one of my little sub-agendas in writing this book, actually I didn't have an agenda when I wrote it, but I realized afterward I did, was to try to get people to read more. So if you got an advanced reader's copy of this book, you would have seen quotes from T.S. Eliot, Jack Kerouac, and W.H. Auden, and other authors who are unfortunately too expensive to get permission to use in this version. So I had to summarize. Now, if you're a writer, think about that. I didn't. I simply wanted to pay tribute to the works that I love. But in terms of getting permission to use a small section of On the Road, four sentences, I was told I would have to pay $4,000. And I decided I'd rather give that money to my favorite charity than, you know. So a portion of my royalties is going to One. I usually wear my One bracelet, which is the campaign to end world poverty. And Bono from U2 is one of their spokespeople. And it's, anyway, I urge you to check out One. It's on the web page for the book. The book has got its own MySpace page, and I urge you to check that out as well if you're a MySpace person. If you're not, my goodness, who are you if you're not into MySpace? I never was until they designed the page, and suddenly now people are, I want you to be my friend, and you're going to be my friend, and it's like being in high school all over again. This is very much a coming-of-age novel for all ages. I think everything I've ever written has been a coming-of-age work in the sense that the protagonist is becoming someone that she wasn't at the beginning of the work. And this book began with a dream, and the dream became the preface, and I thought I'd begin by reading the preface. And then I want to have plenty of time for Q&A because that's the best part of this for me. It keeps me on my game, and I learn a lot this way. On a cool spring night in Savannah, my mother is walking. Her clogs make sounds like horses' hooves against the cobblestone street. She passes among banks of azaleas in full bloom and live oak trees shrouded in Spanish moss, and she enters a green square bordered by a cafe. My father is seated on a stool at a wrought iron table. Two chessboards spread across the table, and my father has castled on one when he looks up, sees my mother, and drops the pawn, which falls against the tabletop and rolls onto the sidewalk. My mother dips to pick up the chess piece and hands it back to him. She looks from him to the two other men sitting at the table. Their faces are expressionless. They're tall and thin, all three, but my father has dark green eyes that somehow seem familiar. My father stretches out a hand and cups her chin. He looks into her pale blue eyes. I know you, he says. With his other hand, he traces the shape of her face, passing twice over the widow's peak. Her hair is long and thick, russet brown, with small wisps that he tries to smooth away from her forehead. The other men at the table fold their arms, waiting. My father has been playing both of them simultaneously. My mother stares at my father's face, dark hair falling away from his forehead, straight, dark eyebrows over those green eyes, lips thin but shaped in a cupid's bow. Her smile is shy, frightened. He drops his hands and slides off the stool. They walk away together. The men at the table sigh and clear the chessboards. Now they'll have to play each other. I'm going to see Professor Morton, my mother says. Where's his office? She waves her hand in the direction of the art college. He puts his hand on her shoulder, lightly, letting her lead. What's this, a bug in your hair? He says suddenly, pulling at what seems to be an insect. A barrette. She takes the copper dragonfly from her hair and hands it to him. It's a dragonfly, not a bug. He shakes his head and smiles. He says, hold still, and carefully slides a lock of her hair through the dragonfly, then pins it behind her left ear. They turn away from the college. They're holding hands now, walking down a steep cobblestone street. It's growing dark and chilly, yet they pause to sit on a cement wall. My mother says, this afternoon I sat at my window watching the trees grow dark as the sun went down. I thought, I'm growing older. I have only so many days left to watch the trees darken. Someone could count them. He kisses her. It's a brief kiss, a rough touching of lips. The second kiss lasts longer. She shivers. He bends to cover her face, forehead, cheeks, nose, chin, with small, quick brushes of his eyelashes. Butterfly kisses, he says, to keep you warm. My mother looks away, amazed at herself. In a matter of minutes, she's let so much happen without hesitation or protest, and she isn't stopping it now. She wonders how old he thinks she is. She's sure she's older. He looks about 25, and she has recently turned 30. She wonders when she should tell him that she's married to Professor Morton. They stand up and walk on, down concrete steps leading toward the river. At the bottom of the steps is a closed cast iron gate. I hate moments like this, my mother says. Her shoes can't climb gates. He climbs over the gate and opens it. It wasn't locked, he says. As she passes through, she has a sense of inevitability. She's moving towards something entirely new, yet predetermined. Without any effort at all, she feels years of unhappiness being erased. They walk along the strand beside the river. Ahead, they see the lights of the tourist shops, and as they reach them, he says, wait. She watches him go inside a shop that sells Irish imports, and then loses sight of him through the door's wavy glass. He comes out carrying a soft wool shawl. He wraps it around her, and for the first time in years, she feels beautiful. Will we marry? She wonders, but she doesn't need to ask it. They walk on, a couple already. My father tells me this story twice. I have questions, but I save them until he's finished for the second time. How did you know what she was thinking? Is my first question. Later, she told me her thoughts, he says. Well, what happened to Professor Morton, I ask next. Didn't he try to stop her from leaving him? I am 13, but my father says I'm going on 30. I have long dark hair and blue eyes, and except for the eyes, I take after my father. Professor Morton tried to keep your mother, he says. He tried threats, he tried force. He'd done it before when she talked about leaving him. But this time she was in love, and she wasn't afraid. She packed up her things and moved out. Did she move in with you? Not at first. No, she took an apartment downtown near Colonial Cemetery, an apartment that some people still say is haunted. I look hard at him, but I'm not going to be distracted by the haunted apartment. Who won the chess game, I ask. His eyes open wider. That's a very good question, Ariella, he says. I wish I knew the answer. My father usually knows the answer to everything. Could you tell she was older than you? I ask. He shrugs. I didn't think about it. Age has never mattered much to me. He stands up, goes to the living room window, draws the heavy velvet curtains. Time for you to sleep, he says. I have 100 more questions. But I nod. I do not object. Tonight, he's told me more than ever before about my mother, whom I've never seen, and even more about himself. Except for one thing, the truth he doesn't want to tell, the truth I'll spend years trying to understand, the truth about who we really are. So that was more or less the voice that came out of the dream I had about, oh my gosh, a year and a half ago now. And I wrote it down. I liked the voice. This is how a lot of my fiction begins, both with the short stories I've written and other things. I wake up with a narrative voice in my head, and people tend to roll their eyes when I say that. It's like, she says she hears voices in her head, but I think most writers do. So when you wake up with a narrative voice in your head, please write it down. And I tell my students this, you lose so much when you don't write down your dreams. And this book came to me so much more easily than anything else I've written. Within a couple of weeks of the dream, I had 3 chapters. But even stranger, I had a map of the whole book. I was able to map 13 chapters, a map which I didn't follow necessarily when I actually wrote it. But I'd never been able to envision a whole before. And I think it's because her voice, Ari's voice, was so strong with me that it carried me through the plot and made it interesting. When I finished writing the book, and it was sold before I finished it, my agent had 2 offers for it from Scribner and Simon & Schuster, and I had that wonderful situation few authors have of choosing my editor based on actually 2 phone conversations. I thought I'd go with Scribner. And originally, but once I talked with Denise Roy at Simon & Schuster, there was no contest. We were clearly on the same page, same wavelength, whatever you want to call it. And so I've had a sublime experience of working with an editor who's like a member of my family now, an agent who's like my sister, and a publisher generous enough to send me around to places like this where I can meet extended family members. So it's been really fun. The book was fairly easy to write, as I said, but when I reread the book, when it was done, I realized I didn't want to say goodbye to my characters yet. And have you had this experience? So the sequel is, I have about 2 pages written. And I have a deadline of November 1st for the manuscript. So my summer is going to be, I'm going underwater. And most of my friends know this now. I say, see you in a couple of months. And they're good. I mean, some of them resent it mightily that I'm not a shoulder for them to cry on for 2 months. But I submerge, and sometimes that's what you have to do. The writing process itself to me is kind of mysterious, but I know that I'm good for about 3 hours a day. If I write more than that, I get sloppy. Yeah. And if you find out what time works for you, you really need to respect that if you can. I know it's hard if you're working a regular job, but if you're an academic like me, you can take your summers off and disappear. I have another section I can read about invisibility, which is one of my pet fetishes, but I thought first I'd give you a chance if you have any questions. Again, the book is about Ariella Montero, who lives in Saratoga Springs with her dad. He's homeschooling her, giving her a classical education, and the education proves to be not so useful when she goes out into the real world and tries to find her mother. The book moves from Saratoga Springs to Asheville, North Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, and then down to Florida, which is where I live now. Homosassa Springs, Florida. Has anybody ever heard of Homosassa Springs, Florida? It's the city with the most S's in it of any city. And that's why I chose it. I'd never been there, but then I went for a week's research and took a camera, took my notes. And the Society of S stands for the letter S, which is lucky for Ariella's mother. It also stands for Sanguinist, which is a group of vampires who tend to be humane, vegetarian, ethical people. Why shouldn't the vampires be the good guys? This was what I thought. I grew up just loving Dracula movies and thinking, I don't see why they get such a bad rap. So I'm a contrarian by nature. So my vampires are sometimes good guys. And it also stands for synesthete, which is the ability to see language in colors, which some of us have. I have it intermittently. Some of us in the audience have it more often, I'm hearing, and I think it's a wonderful trait. To all the other synesthetes in the audience, I apologize for the cover, which in which the S is golden, because my S, personal S, is blood red, too. It's funny. Vladimir Nabokov is another author who claims that his mother was a synesthete, and he was as well. He saw language in color. It's a great, with me, it's inconsistent. It comes and goes, but when it's happening, you know, these words kind of float like dust motes through the air in front of you. Wonderful stuff. All right. Thank you.
In a future where noir, cyberpunk, and visceral horror make mind-bending bedfellows, the only thing that separates a forsaken urban sprawl from a half-finished technological utopia is 16 miles of river. They're known as the Failed Cities. Two worlds populated by shadow agents, street soldiers, reluctant detectives, and femme fatales. When a single conspiracy touches them all, the story can only be told in their voices. Ethan, the street preacher. Truck, the hot-rodding neo-hipster, Knifesmith. The Feral Twins, whose passion for death and each other is the only escape from their own tormented psyches. Just a few of the characters that drive one of the most unique storytelling experiences in fiction today. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son trilogy, calls the Failed Cities monologues gritty, imaginative, believable. T. Morris, author of Moravi, says the Failed Cities monologues creates a chilling tapestry of inner darkness that finds its outside voice. It's not a matter of wanting to listen. You have to. Visit PodioBooks.com to hear the series that's redefining the rules of podcast fiction. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities Monologues by Matt Wallace. 8 lives, 2 cities, 1 story.
And we're back with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, coming live from San Diego, Mysterious Galaxy, with our continued recordings of the 14th celebration of Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore. And just, let's get right to it. Introducing the one, the only, here, everyone yell her name at the same time.
Charlene Harris!
Okay, that's a first for me. Let me tell you where I was 2 days ago. I prepare to be impressed. I want to hear a big ooh. I was on the set of True Blood, which is going to go into production June 7th. Yeah. So it was a very exciting day. I got to meet the dog who will play Sam and the cat who will play Tina. Yeah, I'm going, okay, there's something a little odd about this. But the fact that the animals come in for an interview is just unusual. And I got to watch them build the set. And, you know, it was just wonderful. I just had the best time. I find that more and more of my books are being interpreted in terms of the TV show that's going to be made about them. And that's a strange thing for me, too. The show starts with page one, chapter one, book one. So... now, they'll have to make some changes, inevitably, because this is a different medium. For one thing, all the books are told from Sookie's point of view, and no actress can carry a series to that extent. So there will be changes. But I've read the first two scripts, and I think they're wonderful. So I'm here today. I've been here before. I hope I'll be here again. I'm here today to answer your questions about the series and what I'm doing now. Before I do that, let me tell you a couple of things. Later this year, I've got an anthology coming out that I co-edited with Tony Kellner, who is like my best friend. And all the stories have two themes, vampires and birthdays. And you'd be amazed what 13 different writers can do with the same theme. Half the contributors are mystery writers. Half of them are science fiction writers, and including Kelly Armstrong and Jim Butcher. It's just a wonderful, wonderful anthology. And we are looking to do another one if this one turns out to be as successful as we hope. After that, in October, the next Harper Connelly book will come out, An Ice Cold Grave. And I really think it's the best of the three. So I hope you all enjoy that as well. Now, having done my public service announcement, I am open for business. Yes. Okay, well, as close as I can come to telling you, I decided to write a series about a girl who was dating a vampire. And I worked my way backwards from that. What kind of person would date a vampire? Well, obviously somebody who didn't want to date regular guys, because dating a vampire is pretty scary and not a safe thing to do. So she would have to have something wrong with her. So I thought, well, what could she have wrong with her? Debated the wooden leg thing. Then I thought, no, it would have to be telepathy. And Suki's whole character formed around that initial idea. That's how I worked her out. And she just bloomed from there. Quinn is like my homage to Vin Diesel. Not a mental homage. And I don't know. I just thought Quinn would be fun. Amazingly, a lot of women really don't like Quinn too much. And I'm not really sure why. You know? I know. That's the way I feel. Yeah. That definitely gave me pause, because I had to decide how much to put in and how much to leave out. Since Suki doesn't live in New Orleans, that made it a lot easier. But I still had to acknowledge Katrina just out of respect for the people of Louisiana. Yeah. And so it's part of the book, but it's not the overriding factor in the book. Because after all, I didn't write the book until several months after Katrina, and I'd had time to decide how I was going to use it. Anybody else? Yes, Mary Elizabeth. I do. Just about every single day I go neener, neener, neener. Because this is like my 26th year as a published writer. And And for so long I was the person nobody knew. When I would call up a bookstore, they would go, "Who?" And I would think, "Oh, you know, that hurts." Writers really have an ego like the plant in Little Shop of Horrors. Feed me, feed me. And now, when I call a bookstore, generally, this is just for my own amusement, I go, "This is Charlene Harris." And I thought, wait for it, wait for it. And they go, "Oh, my God." And yes, I do get a big kick out of that. I got to admit, I'm human. Another question? Yes. You know, inspiration is a much abused word. I create people as I need them for the series. If you're acting, I don't know, that makes it sound as if a ray of light came down and a picture of Eric was in it. I needed a head of the vampires, and Eric was there. I just thought, let's get somebody really good, somebody exciting. And then Eric just grew from that initial appearance into a very important character in the series. Yes. Unfortunately, my time is just as full as it possibly can be. The interesting thing about Lily is when I wrote her, I thought, you know, this is the best I can do. And people voted with their pocketbooks on Lily Bard. That series got cut for lack of sales. And I think now, you know, if everybody who tells me they loved it had bought it in hardback, I'd still be writing. So that just shows the power of the pocketbook, guys. I loved writing that series, though I really did. I had come to feel that I had done Lily justice, and I didn't want to dilute the character. So I might not have written them anyway, not to make everybody here feel guilty. But no, Aurora, I just don't have the time. I loved writing the Aurora books, and I came to feel that she was my best friend, and I could have, you know, chugged along with those for forever. But I just don't have the time. They'll be bringing those all out next year, all the Auroras. So, yeah. If you're asking me how many more I have contracts for, I fulfill my contract for the Harper books. I may write one more. I have a contract for 3 more Sookies, and I feel very confident that they will ask me to write some more after that. You know, if everything keeps going well. But as far as how many I plan, I don't really plan, per se. I just take it as it comes, and whatever hits me next, that's what I'll write. There may be 2 Sookies next year. That's a possibility. The Harper's already written, you know, for this year, but next year, not. Right now, I'm like the 400-pound canary. No jokes, please. I'm like the 400-pound canary at my publisher's now. I'm in the happy position of pretty much being able to do anything I want to do. That's not going to last. I give it maybe 2 years. Then they'll go, oh, I'll answer a call. Oh, tomorrow.
Hello, this is Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author Robert J. Sawyer, the author of Rollback, and you are listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
And welcome back to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. We are live from Mysterious Galaxy. Today, I'm very happy to introduce a man who makes me laugh very, very hard, and sometimes in an embarrassed way when I'm in public and I'm reading his book, as Linda laughs in public. Yes, and she's clearing her throat back there, and had to put his book down at the laundromat, I guess, because she was laughing so hard and people thought she was a crazy person. So, yeah. Yeah, her back is turned, so, you know, make all the inference you want. He's written 3 books so far: Gil's All Night Diner, All Fright Diner. Ooh, I'm sorry. It says All Night Diner on the back. That was very confusing. All Fright Diner, In the Company of Ogres and a Nameless Witch. And please join me in welcoming the hilarious, the deranged, and the brilliant Ailey Martinez. I meant deranged in a good way, by the way.
Am I supposed to say something? I have nothing prepared. Thank you. I guess I'll just take questions. I'm done. I'm ready. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate that. My next book is The Automatic Detective. I think it comes out in February. I'm not sure. I just write them. I don't pay attention to anything else. And it's a retro sci-fi robot detective story. It's kind of like you took all those old-fashioned science fiction movies and stuck them together with all those old-fashioned crime novels, and then you whipped it together, and there you go. That's what it is. And that's it. I don't know.
There's a question in the back.
Okay. Well, it's part of my angry farm animals motif. you just think of... I mean, it's kind of like with Gills. I had the zombie cows because I was like, take zombie, make it a cow. That's a big zombie. That's scary. And I always think of... And I was just writing the scene with where she meets her familiar, and I was like, well, ducks aren't that scary, but they can be if they're... If you give him enough demon, so I just thought that was kind of I have no good reason for anything I do. My favorite writers are Edgar Rice Burroughs. I love Edgar Rice Burroughs. I like Michael Moorcock. I like Robert Asprin and more typical stuff. I mean, but my favorite is Burroughs, and I love Tarzan, and I love the Mars books, and nothing even comes close to that. So that's it for me. Well, I don't know if my outlook is... I want to get paid. So the more people... I don't care if people buy it because they need doorstops. So as long as people are buying the books, I don't care why they buy them. And I don't think they're really that... I appreciate the introduction. I don't think they're that strange myself. So it's kind of sad because I realize I may be strange. Because otherwise, I... As long as people... I think people should like them. If I didn't... I'm not surprised people like them. I'm surprised more people don't like them. Because, did I mention I'm brilliant? And, but I mean, that's what I'm here for. When you start this career, you're going in, I'm going to get paid to make crap up. And so I'm not surprised. I'm surprised. I wish more people would read them, you know? So you got to be kind of arrogant to be a writer, I think, to think I'm going to hey, someone will pay me to write. I mean, that's a crazy idea. I still can't believe people do it. Well, it's the same thing that motivates me for everything in my life, boredom. I just was about to graduate high school, and I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I just decided, I told my mom, I was like, well, I think I want to try writing. And she said it was cheaper than sending me to college for 4 years. and which I would have done badly at, because I'm dumb. And so I had to, so after that, about 4 years later, I was still unpublished, and she was behind me the whole way. And so I'd like to give credit to my mom, who this is, without her support, I couldn't have done this because I'm lazy and dumb. And so that's why I did it. And after a while, I just was really enjoying doing it and had a lot of good people behind me. And that's what got me going. And after that, I couldn't stop. So I wasn't one of those people who, like, you know, you hear people say, I've always written. I wasn't one of those people. I just started doing it randomly one day. And it was probably about 15 when I started. My way I was doing it was I would write a book about anywhere from 8 to 12 months, finish it, polish it, send it out, and I'd be working on other things while I was sending it out. And so it was like a big cycle. I had, like, it's the buckshot theory. Throw as much in the air as possible and maybe you'll hit something. So I probably had about 12 novels finished before Gills was finally accepted. It's always a hard question to answer because I know people like, how can you be insulting when somebody is like, I really liked your book and I'd like to read more of it. That's a great compliment. But for me, what I like so much about it, particularly fantasy and science fiction, is when I pick it up, I'm reading something I don't know what to expect. And so much, I don't want to point fingers because they're all great and I'm glad that they exist. But it's hard for me to buy modern fantasy and science fiction books because it'll be like book 7 of the, oh God, I don't want to have to know everything that happened in 6 books. And I also think it's kind of stifling for writers to get stuck writing one idea. I think we're creative people and we should strive to push our barriers. And I love writing because I'm always trying something I haven't done before. And when you're writing a series, there's a certain, if people like it, that's great. But for me, I enjoy the pressure and the challenge of it. And after a while, after you're writing a series a while, it's not really that much pressure. It's like talking to somebody you know. You already know everything that's going to happen. You already know the characters. You already know the setting. There's nothing there to change it. And I like to be challenged. And I think I also like that people aren't tricked into buying more of my books. To be continued. No. So far, you just pick it up, you put it down. The only reason to read another one of my books is because you enjoyed it. And I like that. You know, I get this question a lot, and I'd like to say there was some magical technique I had, some kind of meditative trance, but it's none of that. It's just, I write a lot of this as I go. So almost all of these start with a very basic idea, and then later on the story forms itself without me ever actually consciously taking the time to mold it. So a lot of times, I can't tell you where the idea comes from other than, I'll get one. Okay, I have an origin story for Gills. I was watching a Don the Dragon Wilson movie, which is why he's got a dedication, and it was called Night Hunter, and he's fighting vampires in that. And at one point, he's like fighting the Prince of Vampires, and I was with my mom, and I was like, no, that guy over there is the Earl of Vampires. And I was like, well, actually, he's just a vampire named Earl. And then the rest of it just kind of fell in place because I like the whole Earl vampire. And it kind of ended up leading to the sort of combination of the Southwest and the old Transylvanian village kind of idea. Now, I have a website, official website, www.aleemartinez.com. I have a MySpace page, MySpace/A_Lee_Martinez. And it's really nice that we live in this age where people can email you directly and you can really talk to people. There's a lot of people I really enjoy it when somebody comes over and emails me. And I don't get that many. So it's not like, I mean, it's always funny because I'll get an email and somebody will be like, oh my God, you wrote back. And I'm like, I get like one a week. I'm more like, oh my God, you wrote me. So it's really nice. And it's really nice to have that, that my website was set up by a fan. So I really do enjoy, of course, you know, it's nice to hear from people and hear when they like your stuff. Because that's what I'm, you know, it's like a customer. You want to hear somebody say something good. And especially when someone takes the time to actually write you or get in touch with you in any way. It's really a compliment, and there's no way to say that besides thank.
Okay.
Thank you.
Battlestar Galactica. Joys of driving in my Prius with Bluetooth. The forces of light and darkness on Wikipedia. These are some of the topics I discuss in my weekly commentaries on lightonlightthrough.com. I'm Paul Levinson, lightonlightthrough.com.
I first met Terry Hertzler on the floor of our new bookstore 14 years ago this week. He was blowing up balloons at an awesome rate. Had no idea who this guy was. But here's this guy, and he's working all day, and he's working for free, and he insists on being the first customer, and we have his dollar bill framed somewhere and so forth. And he's going to tell you how he has continued the tradition of being our first customer, one of our best customers, and certainly a friend of Mysterious Galaxy.
Well, since I was the first customer, I thought I should do something special for the birthday celebrations each year. So for the past several years, I've tried to come up with an idea that would be interesting and unique to help celebrate the birthday party. Last year, I did a combination Sudoku short story, whereas once you solve the Sudoku, you had to look through the numbers, and there was actually a short story built into it as well. And this year, I've written a poem that I wrote especially for the birthday party, and I'd like to read it now. And it's called, God's Trying to Quit Smoking. It's tough. As he grabs a small star to light his cigarette, he tries to remember when he first started, but since his memory predates the creation of the universe, he tends to forget things. He breathes out a stream of smoke, creating a new nebula. God's breath is rather potent. In 100 million years or so, that nebula will be home to a species of sentient sponges that will eventually develop faster than light travel and expand to several galaxies, exterminating three other intelligent life forms along the way. God may or may not notice. He's rather busy. And with an infinite number of parallel universes in which to play, what's a species or three, sentient or not? Intelligence and self-awareness are a bit overrated anyway, God sometimes thinks. He's considering a nap, a long nap, perhaps a few 100,000 trillion years or so, maybe even a Googleplex or two. God's tired, and he hasn't had a good dream since he can't remember. He stubs out his smoke in a nearby black hole, then yawns and stretches out his arms, accidentally crushing a small spiral galaxy that was home to a species that had just eliminated all tobacco-related illnesses and addiction with a universally effective smoking cure. So it goes.
Well, we've heard a lot about vampires, and now for something completely different. I'd like you to help me introduce Marshall Karp, author of Bloodthirsty. Yay!
Hi, this is an amazing community. I was reluctant to come here. I said, why do I want to go to a bookstore's birthday party? But this is just not only a great bookstore, but it's a great book community. So thank you very much for inviting me. And then I looked at the program, who's before me and who's after me, and I see that, I don't write about really bloodsuckers or flesh eaters. How do I fit in? And I thought, oh, wait, I write about Hollywood. So this is weird for me, mainly because I've been a writer all my life. I started out as an advertising copywriter, and actually early on had some terrific success. And the punishment for being a good writer in the advertising business is to put you in a suit, put you in a client meeting, put you in an airplane, and suddenly you're not writing. So after about 10 years of running an advertising agency, I sat down one day and wrote something, showed it to a lawyer who happened to be Kurt Vonnegut's manager. And he said, well, this is funny, but you should write a play. I didn't know anything about writing a play. So if you want to write a play, I'll tell you what this guy told me to do, which is go to the bookstore and buy 50 plays. And so I read everything Neil Simon ever wrote, and I read Woody Allen. I read all, you know, the comic playwrights, Bruce J. Friedman. I wound up writing a play. I'm basically a character person. To me, what drives the story are the characters in the story. And after reading Neil Simon, I thought, like, who's an interesting character? And I thought, that guy from Sunshine Boys, that older guy, if you are 35 years old and you say something wise-ass to a woman, you're going to get smacked. If you're 70, oh, he's such a cute old guy. It's like, yeah. So that's funny, except now that I'm pushing it, you know. It's like, you know, I created a guy who was a absolutely cantankerous old retired New York City cab driver, 72 years old, and the title of the play is Squabbles. He loves to argue. In fact, he thinks that's how you live. To argue is to live. And unfortunately, his wife got sick, and so he laid off on the argument, and 2 weeks later she died. Well, now he knows that he screwed it up, so he winds up moving in with his daughter and son-in-law because he has some heart trouble, which he won't admit. And by the end of, like, you know, the first scene, we find out that the groom's mother has to move in. And, you know, this is something I remember walking around with my wife one day, and I said, I have a character idea. What would happen if your father moved in with us? She goes, oh, my God. And then my mother moved in. She said, well, we would move out, you know. And that's what, you know, so the play is about this couple who is living with their respective married children. They hate each other. And, of course, the wife is pregnant. So by the end of Act 3, it's actually a two-act play, but in a dinner theater it's three acts because they can sell just enough alcohol during intermission to make ends meet. But by the end of the play, one of them has to get kicked out. Well, it opened in Kansas City in a dinner theater, and I spent a couple of weeks with it rewriting it, and then it moved on and got reviewed in Boston, and all of a sudden it got published by Samuel French. And that's 25 years ago, and it still plays not only all around the country and all around North America, especially Canada, but it's been translated into several languages, including it was done in Budapest, and they sent me the reviews. Well, I have an older cousin who is Hungarian, so my play is in Hungary. Would you read my reviews? And she reads the review, and I said, what does it say? You don't want to know. So better that I'm here than in Budapest, I think, you know. It's a more receptive audience. What happened was I'm still running an advertising agency, creative director of an advertising agency, and now a studio, Columbia Pictures, got a hold of it, a producer, and he went to one network who liked Squabbles and thought, well, maybe it'd be a television show because the characters could sustain, you know, two people who argue. Hey, I'm married 38 years. Two people who argue, you know, are more fun than two people who just, you know, are holding hands. So ABC asked me to write a pilot of Squabbles, and CBS wanted me to write a pilot of Squabbles. So ABC won, and if that's for me, I'm busy, okay? I wound up writing a pilot for CBS, too, and all of a sudden, full-time day job, I am now the go-to pilot writer. And it's really interesting. I'm going to say something in my third book about, I believe that there is I have the birds do it, bees do it philosophy of writing. They pay you a lot of money to write a pilot. They pay you just, you know, scale to write the second episode, the third episode, the fourth. And that's because if you give 100 songwriters the assignment, write a song about love. They're all going, okay, I love you, you love. And then Cole Porter says, birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it, let's fall in love. Well, now the other 99 writers can do the second verse. They're going bats and cats and monkeys and donkeys. Because when you crack the code, and so I wound up writing pilots, and it was, I had a full-time day job, and I wound up writing two pilots that got picked up for series, and on the second one was a show called Everything's Relative with Jason Alexander. It was the very last show that Jason did before he did something successful. But I decided, you know, I was going through midlife crisis, which is another book I want to write. I wound up in leaving the advertising business and going off into the television business. Well, my show, Everything's Relative, crashed and burned after 11 episodes, but they had such a huge party for me at the advertising agency that I decided, I'm from New York. You couldn't tell, could you? I didn't have that laid-back California look, right, you know? So I went off to Hollywood to work in 19, to work on what was a hit show back then called Amen. It was, you know, Sherman Helmsley, the little guy who plays George Jefferson, you know? And I worked on that, and that was a lot of fun, except for the fact that my wife and children were in New York, and I'm in Los Angeles. And so I was miserable on a personal level, and then I wound up, now this is being recorded, I wound up working for a really wonderful man, and it was very difficult for me. Thank you for cooperating, you know. Whoever's listening to this, you know, they can suffer, you know. I wound up getting a real indoctrination into Hollywood, and I spent a couple of years out there working in television business, actually being well-received. I worked in the movie business, and I actually wound up writing a script that got produced, and they made a movie out of it 10 years later. But I finally just decided I missed my family so much I would go back to New York. And in 1995, my son told me about this new thing, Dad, that you'd be good at because you have, you know, all 20 years of marketing experience, and you could write the long form. What's it called? It's like the internet. I don't know anything about computers. You don't have to. And what I had that nobody else back in the beginning of the dot-com era had, remember all those young, back in the day, all those young kids with, you know, nose rings and blue hair, and they could build your website? Well, when they walk into the, you know, marketing director of a big pharmaceutical company or a big financial organization, those guys go like, whoa. But I had the gray hair and the marketing expertise. And they'd be saying, man, we could make your logo spin. And I'd say, who's your target audience? And what is your objective? And do we have a strategy statement? And they go, whew, there's an old guy in the room. Okay. I wound up accidentally with this internet advertising agency, riding the wave and selling it after 4 years. I sold it in 1999. For those of you who can do the math, that was a good time to sell. And in 2000, I said to my wife, my movie came out in 2000. It's called Just Looking. It was directed by Jason Alexander. It was a lot of fun. I said to my wife, I'm going to go up to the country to our little house. I want to take some time off. And how much time? You know, well, we got enough money to live. We don't have enough money to live for anything. You know, don't spend my nest egg. Okay. So I negotiated for 6 months. Actually, that was 6 years ago, and I'm still living up there in the country writing. But it's just because I got lucky. I started to write this book, The Rabbit Factory. I had had lunch with a friend of mine from the advertising business. I call him Jim. You know him as James Patterson. And, you know, we had worked together at J. Walter Thompson. And I pitched the idea of this story to him. And basically, somebody gets killed, and then somebody else gets killed who's connected to the same company. And then again, and he said, well, what's the company? I said, well, and I told him the rest of the plot. I said, I don't know what the company is yet. I just have the idea. I don't know. He said, no, it can't be the phone company or the, you know. He said, it's got to be something interesting, something you know. And you're like, Marshall, where did you, oh, Hollywood, where the flesh eaters are. Well, this is a this book, The Rabbit Factory, takes place in a Disney-esque environment, and they have a theme park, and their mascot, their hero, their Mickey Mouse is Rambunctious Rabbit. And in the very first chapter, I introduce the guy inside the rabbit suit, and it turns out that he is a sex offender who moved to California and didn't register. Have no fear, I kill him at the end of chapter one. And then the murders start to escalate. And what I did is introduce two homicide detectives who work out of the Hollywood Station in Los Angeles. And this is where the character stuff begins. The first guy is Mike Lomax. When we meet him, he is 6 months widowed, and he's in a lot of pain. But his job, his wife died young, and he's, you know, you, what does the writer put into the characters? Well, if there's a sensitive, brooding side of me, and I'm a Gemini, so there is, you know, that's Mike. But I realized right away that he had to have a counterpoint, and that is Terry Biggs, the wise ass from the Bronx, whose goal is to retire from the police department and to become a stand-up comic. The book, The Rabbit Factory, did very well. Actually, Janet Maslin in the New York Times absolutely loved it. She didn't want to admit it in print. One of the things she said is that, you know, what Marshall does is he's so good at marketing that she feels like I'm selling this, you know, because of the way it unfolds. But she also said brings to mind Robert B. Parker, Janet Ivanovich, Dean Koontz, Stuart Woods, and a lot of other fast-paced authors. If you like that kind of crap. One of the things I did in the publisher's catalog this year is quote that and say, if you are looking for a, you know, for great literature, you know, my publisher, if you're looking for Steinbeck or Hemingway, you know, or, you know, my publisher has a lot of great, you know, but if you're looking to sell books, you know, that are commercial and that remind people of Ivanovich or Robert B. Parker, you know, you should read my rave review in the New York Times. This book caught on. It really did. It did well in hardcover. And I took 4 years to write this book. I was interrupted by 9/11. I think you should tell me how much time I got left because I'm going to, 2 minutes? Oh, God. I didn't even get to bloodthirsty. Then I will just say that the next book my publisher wanted, and I wrote it in 4 months, and it is the same two characters. Yeah, the same two characters, and what they're doing now, they're solving another case, and it's so interesting that we're talking about vampires because what happens is the people who are being killed seem to be being drained of their blood, and there's a lot of, you know, rumor going around that maybe it could be a vampire. I thought I would give you, before, you don't have a lot of Q&A for me because you don't know me, but I would want to do two paragraphs from this book because, you know, there's somebody I love, this Terry Biggs guy. He really does want to be a stand-up comic. And so, you know, in the beginning of the book, the first body is found by a garbage man. And in typical fashion, he hears that Mike and Terry may make a movie out of their first case, The Rabbit Factory. And he suddenly senses that they are connected to show business. He immediately does what all, valet parkers and garbage men and you know, anybody else, busboys do. He would either whip out a spec script or a treatment, or in this case, a picture of his wife, who is an actress. And I'll just read you a few paragraphs that get into Terry's character. By 1 o'clock, we had wrapped up at the scene, stopped at a Taco Bell for a couple of Gordita Supremes, which I'm convinced kills more cops than bullets. And we were back in the car on the way to see Barry Gerber's widow. Take a look at this, Terry said, handing me the 8x10 glossy Otis Hairston had given him. Melissa Little, the garbage man's wife. She's white, I said. And blonde and beautiful. And look at her resume. Besides the soap opera, she's done commercials for Budweiser, Honda, and Tampax. I actually remember her from the Budweiser ad. You mean you don't watch Tampax commercials? Mike, My whole life is a Tampax commercial. I live with Marilyn and three teenage girls on the corner of Estrogen Avenue and Drama Queen Boulevard. Rebecca spent the entire month of April crying because some boy told her that her nose was too big. If the freaking house were burning down, Sarah would have to change her shoes at least 5 times before she could make a run for it. Emily's only 15, and she wants to have a huge hunk of shrapnel installed in her belly button and a tattoo of the solar system on her butt. And Al Gore called to say that it has been confirmed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that Marilyn's hot flashes are the real cause of global warming. And I swear to God, Mike, I swear to God in heaven that if I ever come home and find the toilet seat up, I will break down and weep. And then I will take my gun and start firing into the closets because you got to know that one of those crazy hormonal women has to be hiding a man in there. That I applauded. That's good stuff. You should really do one of those open mic nights at a comedy club and try it out. Nah, I'm still working on my material. I'm not ready to do stand-up in public. Even with just you and me in the car, I did it sitting down. So, that's...
All right, we're going to get some customer feedback here, okay? So, first, go ahead and tell us your name.
Michael Seidman.
Michael, and you actually work here. Could you tell us what got you into science fiction literature?
Well, when I was a kid, probably about 8 or 10, I read my first fantasy book, which was Castle in the Attic, and I loved it. And ever since then, it's just been sci-fi fantasy for me.
Once you're brainwashed, there's no going back, because that's basically what you're saying.
Well, pretty much, but I loved it, and, you know, I don't think of it as brainwashing, but yeah, pretty much.
I think of it as brainwashing. I'm brainwashed, but maybe you're not as sick as I am.
I'm pretty sick, yeah.
Okay. All right, moving on. Thank you, Michael. Hello, miss. What was your name?
Michelle Nordahl.
And Michelle, what got you into reading science fiction?
I guess I started in elementary school. I started with Hardy Boys and Star Trek and.
Oh my gosh! I am talking to the female version of myself. This is okay. So, what was the first Star Trek novel you read? Can you remember?
It was Star Trek V. I picked it up, and that scene at the beginning where Kirk is planning to climb El Capitan and Spock and McCoy are there making fun of each other. It just hooked me completely, and I gave up Hardy Boys and turned to Star Trek books.
All right, for me, it was Star Trek The Next Generation, Book 23, Chain of Command by... Okay, now I feel weird. Thank you. And what was your name?
Stella Bloom.
Stella, right? And what got you into science fiction fantasy?
Well, when I was in the first grade, my best friend, Emily Pickerel, thought we should go to the library during recess. And she got us a library pass, and we went to the library, and the librarian introduced us to some good fiction, Anne McCaffrey in particular.
Anne McCaffrey, that's a great start.
So I've been reading her since the first grade.
First grade, and then, so who are some of your favorite authors now?
Terry Pratchett.
Do you read Martinez then?
Not yet, but I think I will.
All right, well, thank you. All right, who wants to be on a podcast over here? I'm looking for victims. And what was your name?
Sherry.
And Sherry, you're looking at the sign books over here. So who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I really like a lot of the paranormal vampires. So Lynn Vale, Christine Feehan, those kinds of things. But my children also like a lot of the sci-fi and vampire books, too.
You Kim Harrison fan?
You know, I actually haven't read her, but I was here when she came in, when she was here, so I need to get a couple of her books as well.
Episode 18 of my show, if you want to hear an interview with her.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, two more victims over here. What was your name?
Kathy.
And you, sir?
Dave.
All right, Kathy and Dave, I am looking to find out what got you into science fiction and fantasy.
Probably my older sister. She read a lot of it. And being a kid sister, you pick up whatever your older sister does. So that was the other big effect that would probably happen was moving to San Diego and then going to the Comic-Con every year for the last, 25 years. And that'll pretty much do it to you.
And you, sir?
Seventh grade. Walked into the library. They had Heinlein on the shelf. And I read, I can't remember what it was, but I was hooked after that one book.
I knew someone was going to say Heinlein in here. And it actually took longer than I expected. So, cool. Well, thank you very much. Well, hi, miss. What is your name?
Mary Elizabeth Hart, huh?
And who are some of your favorite science fiction fantasy authors? And you can't say your husband.
How much trouble are you trying to get me in?
Wait. Let me do this. Who are some authors you really don't like?
How much trouble are you trying to get me in? Let's see. Oh, I really hate that Isaac Asimov and that Mary Shelley. What a horrible person. I'm going to run out of dead people real soon. Oh, J.R.R. Tolkien. So mean. Never go to a J.R.R. Tolkien event.
Yeah, everything he wrote was so derivative, you know?
Absolutely. You know, it's all just directly from... Oh, wait. It's all Tolkien-esque. What am I thinking?
Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult from their song, Dirt. You can learn more about them at magnatune.com. Thanks for listening.